Hi everyone. The theme is just taking a picture and to find some physical and interesting physical phenomena inside. Here we have a picture of water slider. As you can see, the water slider is an insect which can stand on the water without getting wet or going in the deep hell. The question is, how can they stand on the water, and how they do to walk on the water? To answer this question, we are going to give some physical proof or explanation. In my part, I will talk about just surface tension to prove that they can stand on the water. And Nima and Jennifer will talk about physical phenomena in the motion. First, what is the surface tension? The surface tension is a property of a liquid to resist an external force. As you can see here, imagine that this is a drop of water, and all of those are molecules. And due to the attraction of molecules, and in the surface, the molecules in the surface have not enough neighbor. That's why the attraction will be more stronger, and that's caused the surface tension. The unit of the surface tension is just the force per unit of length. So one of the surface tension provides the necessary wall tension for the formation of the liquid droplet. The tendency of to minimize this wall tension pulls the droplet to be spheric, not square or another form or another shape. Let's take a look on this droplet. Inside of a droplet, we have a pressure. Let's say the pressure inside the droplet will be P, and outside will be P0. If we make some deformation in the droplet, we give some external extra work, which is given by deceleration, where gamma is the surface tension, dA is the variation of the surface, delta P is the difference between the pressure inside and outside of the drop, and dV is the variation of the volume when you make some change. And with that, in the equilibrium, this extra work will be equal to zero and give us this relation, which is the Young-Laplace law of the droplet. Through this relation, we can find the radius of the droplet without if there is no gravity. But we don't know really this morning. I think some groups explain what is the shape of the droplet when there is a gravity or some external force. The surface tension, with the surface tension, we can float some object on surface to water. Even the object itself is deeper than the water. Here we can see that a needle can float on the water. And you can try also on that. If you take a coin, for example, a coin of $2, you can float this coin on the water. Imagine that this is a section of the needle. The weight of the there is some force caused by the surface tension. There's two forces, and this is the gravitational force. And at equilibrium, sum of the force will be equal to zero, which gives us this relation where the angle theta is somewhere between this force and the horizontal, this vertical component of force, and give us this relation. And through that, we can find, we can compute the surface tension of any water, of any liquids, not only water, by finding the maximum density of needles, for example. This is the density of the needles, and this is the gravity. So through that, we surface tension can explain why the droplet is spheric, why some metals and can float on the surface, and why water ladder can't stand on the surface. So I will give my speech to Jennifer to talk about motion.
So now that we know how water striders can float on the water, now the question is, how can they move? And so if you've ever seen a water strider kind of flitting about on the water, you see that you can still observe their path based on the little ripples that they leave behind. And so the first idea of how they move is that they use these ripples called capillary waves to propel themselves. And so capillary waves, they're waves formed by surface tension. And so you've all seen these when you've looked at like a pond or something, just the tiny little fluctuations, not the big ones. Those are gravity waves, and those effects are from gravity, obviously. But so capillary waves are formed from surface tension, which means they have to be small, since surface tension affects only about 1 centimeter. And so how they work is when there's a deformation in the surface of the water flowing under it will change in the pressure based on Bernoulli's law. And so if it's when it's pressed down, then the water will flow faster under it, pushing it back up, and vice versa when you have a crest. And as you might guess, larger surface tension gives greater speed, much like if you have a stronger spring constant, it'll give you a faster oscillation. But the important thing to know about these capillary waves, which will be important when we try to figure out if this is how they move, is that they have a minimum speed based on the surface tension of the water, the density. And if the speed of the wave is slower than this, then they won't form. So next, we'll talk about water striders. And so here you can see a water strider. Well, you could see it moving on the water. And you could see the little ripples that form when it moves. So water striders have a bunch of things that help them be able to walk on water. So their bodies are covered in tiny hairs that are water resistant. And so these hairs do a couple of things. First of all, they keep the water strider from getting wet. And they also trap air. So this is why. This is kind of unrelated, but this is why water striders won't sink if it's raining, because these, even if they get pushed underwater, the hairs will trap the air, and then they'll be able to float back up. But and they have a wide range of sizes, you know, as we heard before. You can float things that are even pretty large just because of the surface tension. And so the thorax, the middle section of them, ranges from 1.5 to 36 millimeters. So now the question is, are these capillary waves how they move? And so the principle is that when the water strider rests on the water, it creates a small dimple in the water. And when it moves its leg backwards, this would create a wave, much like you see when a boat is moving somewhere. You see the waves behind it. But the problem with this is that the capillary waves have a minimum speed. And so when they're infants, they can't move their legs as fast because they're, you know, they're shorter legs. And so they just aren't able to move their legs fast enough to produce these waves. And the other problem is that their legs are very waxy, which is good because it means they can float on the water because it's water resistant, but it also means that there's not much friction between their legs and the water surface. And so if they tried to just kind of walk on the water like we walk on the surface, you know, on the floor here, then they would just kind of slip around like, you know, wearing rollerblades or something. So even though you can see in the last slide that some of these waves, they do form capillary waves, this can't be the only way that they get around because they wouldn't be able to form them when they're young. And it turns out if you look at how much energy these waves carry, it's about a tenth of the momentum that the water strider has when it's moving. So it is some proportion of, it does help with their motion, but it's not the dominating effect. So.
Okay, so far my colleagues told you what the problem was. The problem was we don't know how to account for the things moving on water. Now, maybe the problem is that there's obviously some other mechanism involved. Obviously, it's not the waves. They just don't carry enough momentum. So maybe these things are actually rowing on water. Well, that would be like if you compare the two pictures side by side. It turns out the... So before I go on, I must say that all of the calculations I've done, like Jennifer said, these things vary in size. They can get up to 20 centimeters big. I'm only going to talk about all the analysis is done for 1 centimeter long striders. So the numbers that I'm going to throw at you are going to be for 1 centimeter long striders. So it turns out for a 1 centimeter long strider, the legs are going to be only 40 micrometers thick. So that'll be like trying to kayak with a pencil for your paddle. So that's not going to work out so well. So it's not really feasible anatomically, but there's other problems. So other problems being the fact that my video is not working. Oh, it is, okay, cool. So the other problem is that, well, a bunch of people were interested, so they videotaped these guys while they're moving. So you can see this thing is jumping. So from the video, from the mass of these things, you can find the trajectory, you can tell what kind of force this thing is imposing on water, which was what Jennifer was alluding to. So it turns out for these guys, on average, that part of the leg that's in contact with water is about 0.3 centimeters. The amount of force that puts down on water per unit length is about 0.8 millinewtons per centimeter. Now it turns out for water at 20 degrees, the maximum force the minimum force you need to put down to actually penetrate the water is about 100 or 1.4 millinewtons per centimeter. So even when they're jabbing their hands down, they actually don't penetrate the surface. So that's another problem with saying that these guys actually roll on water. So what is it that's actually going on? So it's a bit like, okay, so equations are good, but sometimes pictures are better. To see what's going on, picture a very slippery trampoline, and you're lying on the surface of a slippery trampoline and trying to move forward. So like she said, if the movement of your hands are slower than the lowest speed of the waves, you're actually not going to create waves. Furthermore, the waves that move on the trampoline aren't going to have enough momentum to let you move forward. So, but what we're forgetting is that there's actually water underneath that trampoline. So, as calculated from the trajectory, on average, every stroke of the leg is about 0.01 seconds. So you can tell that the momentum imparted is 0.5 gram per centimeter second. So since there's water underneath, and these guys can't penetrate the water, they create a dimple in the water. Now the dimple they created is actually 0.1 centimeter, which is big enough to be a paddle if they were to swim. So maybe this is what they're doing. Maybe what they're doing is that they're creating paddles by deforming the surface of the water. And so what would that do? What that would do is it would give you a way of putting energy into the water underneath the surface, even though you're actually not dipping into the surface. So they put some food coloring in water and put these guys on them. And you can see as they swim, the waves go on the surface, but there is vortices that form underneath. And people studied these. They turn out in size to be, in my approximations, they're hemispherical. There is no vortices. There are actually hemispheres of water turning. And they have on average a size of 0.4 centimeter. And they're moving back at about the rate of 4 centimeters per second on average. These numbers are from a paper from people who actually did the experiment. And they're rotating at about 1 hertz. Now, can these things account for the momentum imparted? Well, it turns out that, if you calculate the amount of momentum, if I assume that they're putting their hands on the edge of the hemisphere and turning the thing, from the rotation alone, that's also 1/10 of the momentum. So that's 0.05. I need actually 0.5. So that's not enough. But it turns out the actual body of water moving backwards at 4 centimeters per second is actually enough. It ends up giving you 1.5 grams per centimeter second, which is grams centimeters per second, which is actually the momentum I need. So that solves the problem. So we found that basically what's happening is that these things are actually swimming, but they're also walking because they're not really penetrating the surface. So it is the disturbance of the water underneath the surface that allows these guys to move on the surface of the water. So in conclusion, we showed how surface tension lets these guys stand on top of water. We've showed that although your first guess would be that these things move because there's waves that carry away momentum, that's not the case. They actually disturb the water underneath the surface. That's how they move. And I remember I said that they grow at 20 centimeters bigger. I know you guys were trying to picture that. That's the biggest guy. And thank you for listening to us. Yes.
Does the ability to create these deformations and integrate the vortices depend at all on the constitution of the water? Like if you add substances to the water, do they have more difficulty?
Well, it depends. If something that you add to the water, if it's like soap, it's not going to be able to even stand on the surface because it breaks surface tension. But the thing that matters in these vortices, first of all, is the mass of those, so the density of the water. The denser it is, like I said, go back to the trampoline picture. If you have honey under you instead of water, it'll be, so viscosity and density will allow you to push more. So yeah, it'll definitely matter. But as far as being able to float, he'd be better able to answer because that surface tension, some chemicals in water will actually change the surface tension enough that you won't be able to. Actually, that's how you can catch fruit flies. You put vinegar and soap in water and they'll sink because they think they'll be able to float, but they won't.
More about the vortices,
how it helps the
strider to go
along,
because it sounds to me like he's just pushing and then because of the reaction.
Yeah, so, well, the vortices themselves is just what happens underneath the water. It's not necessarily the vortices that help, it's the fact that you're actually displacing a volume of water underneath you rather than just transferring momentum to the surface, which is carried away by the waves on the surface. So the point is you need something to push against, and the surface of the trampoline isn't enough. So it is the water that's displaced underneath the surface that's giving you, I guess, the footing to be able to move forward. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
You guys mentioned, at the start, you mentioned the fact that the surface tension allows it to stay on top of the water, and with regard to the movement, you talked about the hydrophobic interactions. Don't they contribute to the water strider being able to actually stand on water? Because if they're
the micropods, the hairs.
Yeah, the oily nature.
Is it not
a more important factor than the surface tension? Is it more important or?
I think it's
electrostatic interactions would be
important than more important than bending.
Well,
okay.
It's like this: you put wax on a needle. If the needle's density is too heavy, it doesn't matter how much wax you put; it's still going to sink. It's still surface tension. So the wax helps the thing not get wet, but you'll still need to have the right density. It is the surface tension ultimately that's keeping it up. It's not floating. It's just not breaking the surface tension.
Okay.
But if
the two surfaces are repelling each other, that would actually provide a stronger force in keeping the two apart rather as opposed to the surface tension.
But like I said,
just coming from one end, basically the side of the water.
I agree with you, but what I'm saying is if you have an oily needle, it's very hydrophobic, but it'll still sink because it's too heavy.
You just gotta make an estimation of how large is the surface tension compared to the electrostatic force. I guess the electrostatic force is negligible. With respect to the force provided by the surface.
Well, there's also the nanostructuring of it. If the surface won't wet as easily, if it's covered in these bristles.
You'll still sink, though.
Right, yeah.
And if I may, one more thing. Regarding the anatomy itself of the water striders, how does that affect? Because, like, if I have a plank of wood, I sort of lay it out with the greater surface area, I spread it out, it floats on the surface, but if I actually put it longitudinally, it tends to sink. So what about those factors contributing to its ability to stay afloat or up on top?
I think they're light enough that they're able to float even though they only have six legs. And so each of those have some amount, that is in the water.
Yeah.
But it's,
Yeah, and one other thing is that it turns out So the mass of the water strider grows with its length to the cube, typically. But the length of the leg goes like L, so you would think. But it turns out if you actually look in nature, the bigger the water strider, the legs actually don't go like the length. Don't go proportional to length. They actually go proportional to something else. So if you plot them on a log-log plot, you can find the intersection. And you can find like the biggest size. But nature knows better, so it compensates. Obviously, it works. So I'm not sure if that's exactly the answer to your question. I don't know much about the anatomy.
You mentioned about like a $2 being able to float.
Yes.
So, like a which $2? Like a Canadian $2?
I saw some money putting inside of a glass of into the water, or some baking glass and put some water and.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
You gotta be careful.
Thank you.
I think you can also do that kind of thing by putting it on top of a paper towel, and then the towel will sink with the whatever you put on top.
Can we talk more about what happens when it rains, like with the riders, water striders?
I'm not entirely sure. I think the basic idea is that somehow. It's like since the mares are really hydrophobic, then when it rains, if they get pushed down kind of into the water, there's still some air that's trapped in the hairs because I think they're really tiny and really dense. And so even though it gets pushed underwater, it's still got this kind of layer of air around it. And so it'll come back up to the surface.
If I'm not fast enough to do this, but if I like push the water strider down with my finger underwater, it just like float back up.
The rainwater.
You'd have to try it actually.
I don't know. It probably depends on how long it's underwater.
I don't see why the 20 centimeter one, if you push it down, I don't see why that one would come up.
It may not have enough air, but probably also is not going to be pushed into the water. So it's some sort of balance between how much air they can trap. So.
Was any water striders harmed in the performance?
No.
We're not that good.
Okay, probably we should thank the speakers again.
Monday and Seth will tell us about Bird's Eye View of Credit of Care.
All right, so here's a picture of a bird I took. It's not very good because I couldn't get very close to a bird. But basically today we're going to tell you a bit of the story of how of one idea of how birds managed to migrate so far and still find their way. And so this is the idea of the avian compass, which is the idea that birds have a magnetic sense that actually allows them to sense magnetic fields. And that's one mechanism by which they travel so far and still find their way. So in this talk, we're going to explain a bit about the avian compass, explain some experiments that have been done on it, and then suggest one model called the radical pair model. And that model involves some quantum entanglement, so we'll get into that a bit. And then we're going to talk about one other alternative model, but some problems that it has. So the avian compass, as I said, is this idea that birds can actually sense magnetic fields. Now, there's a few proposed mechanisms for this. One of these mechanisms involves the eye, and that's the one we're going to be focusing on. So this was first discovered back in 1968. There was an experiment done that showed that when birds were deprived of being able to properly sense Earth's magnetic field, they just lost their ability and got completely disoriented. So ever since then, people have been taking a look at this. So in this particular study, they put a frosted lens over the bird's eyes that blocked about 70% of the light. And when it was placed over the bird's right eye, they were disoriented. And when it was placed over their left eye, they weren't disoriented, which suggests that the magnetic mapping sense is only in one half of the brain and not the other half. Now, this is one experiment that suggested that the sense is dependent on the eye and also dependent on light being able to get into the eye. There are some other studies that have looked at magnetic materials in the beak and a nerve that goes from the beak to the brain. And if they snipped that nerve while being cruel to the birds, more so because they were even more disoriented afterwards. But so this might not be the whole story, but we're going to focus on magnetic senses in the bird's eye today. So here's a picture of the bird's eye, and this is the radical pair model. The idea is that a photon of light enters the eye, gets to the back of the eye on the receptors, and interacts with a certain type of molecule. It's going to hit this molecule and excite an electron in this molecule from the highest occupied orbital to the lowest unoccupied orbital. And we'll call this molecule the donor molecule. Now, if there's another type of molecule near the donor molecule, this other type of molecule has already one unpaired electron. And if these two molecules are close enough to each other, then the excited electron can actually migrate over to the second molecule, the acceptor molecule. And then near this acceptor molecule will be a pair of unpaired electrons. And this is what's called a radical pair, because these two electrons, they're near the molecule, but they're kind of separated, and they're radical. They want to get to something. They have a desire to bond with something. And in the short time that they are separated, they become quantum entangled. Now, when you have two spinners, two spin one-half particles, they can be in either singlet or triplet states. And actually, the really interesting thing about this effect, so here you can see the effect again. You have a donor and acceptor, light absorbs, electron transfers, and then you have the state where you have these two electrons that are either in a singlet, they start in a singlet state, but in the presence of a magnetic field, they can oscillate to the triplet state. So they can oscillate back and forth between the singlet and triplet state. And the interesting characteristics of these two molecules is when they relax, when the entanglement is broken and they relax back to their initial states, or relax back to a relaxed state, the state they relax back to depends on whether these electrons were in the singlet or the triplet state when they relaxed. Now, the mechanism by which the birds can detect this difference in relaxed state is still something that's unknown. but scientists have seen this in a molecule called cryptochrome. So there is experimental verification that such a thing can happen, that the product of a reaction can depend on the electron state. And this is one proposition of what this might look like. So basically, if there was no magnetic field, the electrons would stay in the singlet state. And the presence of the magnetic field can affect what ratio go into the triplet state before relaxing again. And so you get kind of a grayscale as you go from 100% singlet state to 100% triplet state and anything in between. And that is a measure of the magnetic field in whatever direction and strength that part of the eye is sensitive to. And so this is one proposal of what a bird might see. The top images is just that grayscale of singlet to triplet. And then the bottom images is that grayscale overlaid on the bird's regular vision of the world. So back up here, there are two different decays. And each one of these would assumably have some kind of decay rate. The paper we looked at assumed that that decay rate, K, would be the same for both reactions because they assumed it would be independent of spin. But there's the question, because we don't know what molecule the birds actually have in their eye, we're just guessing at this reaction. They had to figure out what that decay rate might be. So they took a look at how the ratio of singlet to triplet would be dependent on the local magnetic field for various decay rates. And for those who don't remember this number, the Earth's magnetic field is right about here, I believe. Mm-hmm. Or is it right about over there? Oh, well, I believe it's right about here. So you can see that for this, if the decay rate was 10 microseconds, there's very little sensitivity to variation in magnetic field right here. And for this one, it goes up to a maximum so quickly that there's also little sensitivity for variation far from here. But for this one, there's a good linear sensitivity to variation. And so they figured that given birds can do this, evolution would have selected for a molecule with a decay time that allowed for a good sensitivity to Earth-type magnetic fields, just as our eyes are sensitive to the light output by the sun, not any other region of the spectrum. So that's how they made an estimate, a guess at what the decay rate probably was. And then armed with that decay rate, they could try to look at what the sensitivity of this molecule might be to magnitudes and angles of magnetic field. So the last one showed the sensitivity to magnitude. But if you want to be able to turn your head and see something different, you need to be sensitive to the angle that the electron pair makes the magnetic field. So this is what they found for the sensitivity of the angle. And you can see if they're aiming due north, they'll see this. And as they turn off on either side, symmetric on either side, obviously, they'll see different things. I know one thing the study found was that under this model, there would be no sensitivity to the direction of the magnetic field, just the angle. So they would see the same thing looking south as north. The pictures I showed earlier were from a different study than this one. So this study might not have necessarily predicted those exact same pictures. And so as I mentioned before, there's also entanglement that is going on in these electrons. The process I've described so far isn't intrinsically linked to the entanglement. The entanglement exists, but the process in this model doesn't depend on the entanglement. And so in looking for an explanation for the avian compass problem, it isn't necessary to have entanglement, but a lot of scientists are really interested to see if any natural processes actually take advantage of entanglement, because that would be obviously a very interesting discovery to find that some biological system could actually take advantage of quantum entanglement. It's also interesting because these birds seem to be able to do entanglement better than we can. One estimate of the mean lifetime that they can maintain entanglement is about 100 microseconds. And the best that we can maintain entanglement at very, very low temperatures, like near a few degrees Kelvin in a lab setting, is about 80 microseconds. So they can, in room temperature, body temperature systems, maintain entanglement better than we can in the lab. So that's a reason that entanglement in these systems is really interesting to us. So they use this factor called the negativity that I'll admit I don't entirely understand what it's a measure of. But essentially, periodicity in the negativity implies entanglement. So the better, the longer it maintains periodicity for, the longer the entanglement lasts. So you can see in this plot here, for magnetic fields near the value of Earth's magnetic field, both below and above, all three of those curves are right here at the same time. And they spread apart a little bit as time goes on, but all three of those curves stay very near each other. The one for a very large magnetic field that's nothing like Earth is down here. It's kind of hard to see on this. It took me a while to figure out exactly where all the curves were. But what this means is the length and quality of entanglement doesn't really depend too much on the strength of the magnetic field. And over here, they did the same thing with an Earth-strength magnetic field, an angle to the magnetic field, and there is absolutely zero difference. You can't even tell the other curves are there because they're all right on top of each other. So essentially what they found is that the entanglement under this model didn't seem to have any effect, didn't seem to vary at all based on the direction or intensity of the magnetic field. However, this interaction that I've talked about so far was with Earth's magnetic field. Sorry, I forgot to mention something at the start. These electron pairs interact with Earth's magnetic field, but also with a local nuclear magnetic field from the closest nuclei in the molecule via a hyperfine interaction. So this model accounts for both the Zeeman effect of Earth's magnetic field and the hyperfine effect of the local nucleus. And the model up to here assumed a symmetric hyperfine interaction. And so when they got to this point, the authors of the paper thought they wanted to see if they could change their model a bit to find a way that the entanglement could be affected by the magnetic field through introducing an asymmetric hyperfine tensor. And that's what Seth is going to tell you about.
Okay, thank you, Brody. Okay, so Brody was talking about the symmetric hyperfine tensor, which was used to generate this graph. So I'm going to basically talk about the entanglement in this model. So what they thought about was that if we rather use an asymmetric tensor, what will happen? And the symmetric tensor here just means that the two electrons, which in the eye of the bird, they consider them to be in an isotropic environment, meaning that wherever the electrons are, it doesn't depend on the orientation of the electrons in the local magnetic field. So rather, if they chose an asymmetric tensor, it means that now they are considering an anisotropic environment of the two electrons. So the electrons, it depends on the orientation of the electrons, which the magnetic field will be induced. So when they used an asymmetric hyperfine tensor, this is the result they got. So they chose two different asymmetric tensors, and this one of it, and this another result. So we can clearly see that using an asymmetric tensor, we have some variations in the peak. So you can see the colors. So the red for 0 degrees. So the 0 degrees here, 30 degrees, 90 degrees, and 68 degrees. So these angles are the angles between the local magnetic field and then the Z direction. So they just chose an angle between them so that they can see this effect. So what this basically means that then maybe there can be a dependence on the orientation of the local magnetic field of the electrons which are inside the bird's eye. So this motivated them to define a new model, which I'm going to talk about. So in their new model, they considered two things. They proposed that we should consider each electron which are in the bird's eye to interact additional with an additional local magnetic field. So inside, so locally, they chose that, say, a magnetic field, Bi, to be there, which will interact with themselves. So they changed the Hamiltonian of the previous equation by introducing a new magnetic field, say, Bi, in the Hamiltonian. And then they combined this idea with the CHSH inequality. This inequality can be used to prove quantum entanglement. You can use this CHSH, which is the Clausius-Hohm-Schumann-Holtz inequality, to prove the Buzz inequality. The Buzz inequality, violation of the Buzz inequality implies quantum entanglement. So the E here you see here is most times referred to as the quantum correlation. So in this our new model, the E here will refer to the spin correlation between the two pair electrons. And then the lambda you see here in this model is most times refers to the eigenvalue of the measuring operator. So if you measure the spin pairs, so we are considering singlet and triplet here, the singlet and the triplet. So if you measure the probability, if you measure the probability that you get either a singlet or a triplet pair, the maximum is the lambda here. So in this model, they chose the lambda maximum to be 1. That's what they chose to be. So if I get a violation of this inequality, if the E here is greater than 2, then I have that the electrons will be entangled, because you can't explain by classical, you can't explain it classically. So this is the new model they thought about. So when they did this, they got some interesting results here. So we have these four plots. These two plots here, they refer to, so they considered some planar and azimuthal angles, which, because they want to show that the magnetic, the Earth's orientation depends on the magnetic field, depends on the Earth's magnetic field, and also the angle between the magnetic field locally of the nuclear magnetic field of the electrons locally can also change the Bell's orientation. So that's why they did this one. So the red here you see here is a plot using an angle, an azimuthal angle of 0 degrees. The orange here is for 30 degrees, the yellow 60, green 120, 150, one, like going 30 degrees in between them. And then the dash blue line you see here, this is the spin, this is the two spin correlation. So if it's above, if you get a value above this one, then it means that it's entangled. So from all these curves, you see that we get an entangled state between like 60 to 90 nanoseconds. So you can see clearly, so this one is fixing the polar angle, and these two curves are rather fixing the azimuthal angle. So in all these curves, you can see that truly entanglement depends on the angles, the azimuthal angle or the polar angle between the electrons inside the local magnetic field. So then, before I get to the conclusion, let me talk about some model which was done previously. So this is not the only model they've done. Before this model, there was another model which they called a magnetized Bayes mechanism. So in this magnetized Bayes mechanism, what they proposed was that they considered that every the electrons inside have got a magnet, they have magnetic particles, and then the external magnetic field from the Earth's magnetic field will rather exert a magnetic torque on those magnetic particles which are in the eye, and then they would tend to turn the electrons in some way so that they become entangled. But this mechanism, it failed because it couldn't predict that the dependence of light on the magnetic orientation. So Brody talked about that when they put, they block the bird's eye with some, they block the bird's eye with something, then light couldn't, if which blocked about 70% of the light which could enter, then it changed the orientation. So all the experiments which have been performed shows that, yes, truly light depends on the magnetic orientation. But this model failed to prove that. So this model has been disregarded. So to conclude on the rapid base mechanism, so we see that then truly from then truly entanglement decay rate is also one of the factors which affects bird's orientation in the RPM. The RPM is the rapid pair mechanism which we studied. And then also entanglement also can endure enough to conduct entanglement-based reactions. So in the graphs we saw here, we saw that each time the entanglement can last for a while. And then as Brody said that the entanglement birds can sustain entanglement quite even longer than we can do in the laboratories. So it means that the entanglement can endure enough which to conduct the entanglement-based reactions. So if the entanglement caused the birds to react some way, it's not really well understood how the entanglement affects the birds' orientation. So it's quite clear that entanglement is a factor of the RPM, but it's not yet understood how the bird is affected by this entanglement. Because if they consider cryptochrome, which Brody mentioned, to be a factor of the entanglement, then what's this one? They've not really done any serious experiment to show that the cryptochrome rather induce some signals through the nerves of the bird. So it's still a research area which is going on currently to really understand how entanglement affects the bird's orientation. So thank you.
Questions?
I have two questions. The first one, is this mechanism common to all birds or just birds that migrate?
It's been observed in quite a number of birds. Some of the experiments I talked about, the lens experiment was done on European robins. It's been done on homing pigeons and other non-European robins. I don't remember all the names of the birds, but I know it's been done on at least a dozen birds, but they believe it too. I don't think there's any reason to think it isn't common to most birds.
The other question is, I understand that you are considering this two-electron problem here,
yeah,
right? What justifies using this model of two electrons and not a many-body problem of electrons? Because what you said, that entanglement can be preserved more, like for more time in the Earth's, in the bird's eye than in the laboratories. I don't know until what point that assumption or that fact holds. Isn't it better to treat the problem as a quantum open system where you can see decoherence processes and all of this stuff, which I guess that the time entanglement is inside the bird's eye, it's smaller than in a laboratory due to the coherence basically due to the interaction with the environment of the eye.
Okay, I don't know the particular reasons that these authors chose this model, other than that some work had been done on it and looked fairly promising to explain the experiments that had already been done. A lot of the models, of course, are limited by the experiments that have already been done. I know that they looked really closely at factors of the entanglement, because they were so surprised the entanglement could last so long when there were not just at room temperature, but also so much potential for disturbance in a more chaotic environment.
Right, but the fact is that if you consider just the two-body problem, entanglement is somehow independent of the environment you're considering. You're considering both as isolated, right? But in the moment you couple it to some temperature, some heat, but there are decoherence processes which I think they're stronger and make the entanglement die even faster.
I don't know. They didn't mention anything about that, and I'm not an expert in quantum mechanics, so I don't really feel like I can answer
that. Well, if I can just, so related to that, do you know what the relative, I mean, there are some magnetic fields in the brain. Do you know what the relative strengths of those compared to the Earth's field are?
No, I think, I would guess they, well, the magnetic fields in the brain just compared to Earth's field, I don't think would be anywhere near as strong. I mean, they might be strong on a local scale, but not as far away as the...
Because, I mean, they'd presumably be pretty random, so they'd have this decohering effect.
I mean, unless you can pull the compass up to the side of your skull and see some effect on the needle, then you're not having magnetic fields as strong as Earth's magnetic field near your head.
Jake, I guess my question is kind of related to the previous one. Is any of this work on entanglement based on experiment, or is it all just based on these very limited theoretical models?
I guess they are based on these models because
it's just on the
because it was just an improvement of the previous model.
But I know it has been looked at experimentally for the molecule cryptochrome, and they have. I believe they have experimentally found cryptochrome in the bird's eye, but they don't know if that's the molecule doing this or if there might be some other molecule that does a similar thing.
And they've measured quantum correlations in...
They've measured quantum correlations in cryptochrome in a lab.
How did they measure them? Like, when you say quantum correlations, you mean entanglement?
I know they've measured that, I don't know if they've looked at specifically quantum entanglement in the lab. I didn't look into that much. But I know that in the lab, they have shown that for cryptochrome, the resulting product is dependent on whether it was in a single or triplet state, like I said earlier. So that's the extent of what I know of what they've done in the lab on cryptochrome.
Yes, sir. Couple of questions. First one, you talked about the free radicals at the start.
Yeah.
Right, so free radicals are a very, very dangerous thing inside an animal's body, and like if I had free radicals going inside me, well, probably I do, but that's a very dangerous thing to have, particularly inside the brain. So I wonder how legitimate that proposal is, because they just mess everything up going inside the brain. So is there some way to shield the rest of the brain against these?
I think the thing about this is a photon strikes and causes this free radical pair to be formed. But then this free radical pair recombines again on a fairly short time scale of, I don't know, depends what you mean by a fairly short time scale, but on a time scale of about 100 microseconds without drifting too far apart.
And secondly, I know you proposed a model which explains the ability to navigate, but could you, you could have simpler models to explain the ability to navigate. What about something to do with, like, do birds have memory? And a lot of animals often, it's like they tend to form big groups with a leader.
Yeah.
And they, so why not those, why not use those to explain their ability to navigate? This is the very...
As I mentioned earlier, there are a lot of models, and I could have gone on for several slides with all the models I've read about. They know that there's magnetic effects that aren't just their memory, because when they've blasted them with magnetic fields, they become completely disoriented. Basically, what they did is took an EM generator, put it next to the bird's head, blasted it for a few minutes, and then let it go outside. And it was completely disoriented. One of the reasons for such a complex model is they need a way to explain why the magnetic sense only works when light is coming into the eye, right? As Seth said, there's this model for a passive effect, which is just always running. But experiment shows this isn't a passive effect because it relies on photons entering the eye, or it doesn't work.
Maybe we should move on.
To ask questions. Do you see your question? Yeah.
Okay. I have a silly question. Do you know if any other animals have this ability?
They know that, I was only reading about this very briefly. I believe there are some signs of it in certain bacteria and in certain insects. Yeah, certain insects and bacteria.
Okay, probably let's thank the speakers. So the last talk today will be the talk given by Jacob, Jeffrey, and Monica, and it is called Fractals in Nature.
So when we were out on our nature walk, one of the things that we noticed was that a lot of objects in nature have a fractal structure. And what we mean by that is that they have some sort of self-similarity and also a kind of scale invariance. So we have a couple, actually, can we turn the lights down? So we have a couple examples of this. One in sort of the biggest scale is the branching structure of trees. They start from a trunk, they branch out, and this keeps branching out into twigs and eventually leaves. And you can actually see this in the leaf with the branching structure of the veins themselves. And you can only see about two or three branches here, but there are actually several within the leaf itself. And then I particularly like this example of the cracks in dried mud, because it points out especially the scale invariant nature of these fractal structures. So from looking at this picture, you can't necessarily tell whether it's a 1 foot by 1 foot square of the ground or maybe a satellite picture of the Sahara. And this crack structure is the same at pretty much all scales. So we, of course, were not the first to notice this. And Mandelbrot, who is probably the name most associated with fractals, spent a lot of time thinking about this when he was a researcher at IBM. And he focused particularly on the lengths of coastlines. And he examined in particular the case of the western coast of England, which apparently is famously convoluted. And he asked, how would you measure such a thing? And the answer is with a ruler, which sounds stupid and obvious, but actually is very important. Because when you measure the edge of an object with a ruler or with a pair of dividers, you're essentially walking it along the boundary, walking your ruler or your dividers along the boundary. And what this means is that the length that you get, which is just going to be the number of walks you take times the width, is very dependent on the width. And so in his paper, Mandelbrot copies this figure from earlier work done by Lewis Richardson, where he empirically plotted some of these lengths against the edge length. And he found this very nice linear relationship between the log of the total length and the log of the ruler length in many different coastlines. And the slopes are different, which I'll come back to. Another thing to notice is up at the top, there's this curve that follows black circles. And that is the log of the circumference of a circle against the log of a measuring length. And it makes sense that this should converge as you decrease your width, because a circle is not self-similar. It's not a fractal structure. And so you're approaching the right length. So you can formalize this notion of self-similarity. And the simplest way to do this probably is to start with a particular unit, which here is just a line segment. And then at each step, you can follow a set of rules to generate the next level, the next generation of the fractal. So here you can see that you start off with a segment, and then you cut it into four parts. And you arrange eight of those parts to form the next generation. So if the ruler length at the nth generation is called this Rn, and there's some scaling factor S, then you have a total length along the fractal curve L. And you have C, some number C of copies of this structure. And what that means is that through some fairly simple manipulation of logs, you get to this relationship on the right, which is precisely the linear relationship on the log-log plot that Richardson had found empirically. And this is a theoretical justification in terms of self-similarity. And it allows you to define this number D, which is called the fractal dimension. which is log C over log S, or the log of the number of copies you get at each generation over the log of the scaling factor. So it's all well and good to call this thing D and say it's a dimension, but if we're going to do that, it probably ought to match up with our intuition about what a dimension is. So for me, at least, I tend to think dimension, number of linearly independent basis vectors. So we can see that if you look at a line segment, a square, and a cube, and of course so on, in higher dimensions, these definitions match up, because if you scale down your measuring stick by a factor of, here, 3, you get 3 copies of a line segment, 9 of a square, 27 of a cube. But this new definition means that we don't have to have integer values of dimension. And you can use it to calculate the fractal dimensions of some more exotic objects like this, which is the Koch curve. And this one, you can see that at each generation, you're getting 4 copies of the last generation scaled down by a factor of 3. So the fractal dimension of this is log 4 over log 3. This is a particularly interesting example because it has a topological dimension 1. It's just a bunch of line segments. But it actually has a fractal dimension 2, so it's space filling. If you continue this down, you will hit every point on the plane. And this is the Sierpinski gasket, which is another quite famous example. So I want just to provide a little bit of motivation as to why, another motivation as to why it really makes sense to call this quantity D a dimension. And this will become important in the next part of our talk, where we introduce some consequences in biology for this. So typically, you would think of a fractal from sort of a top-down perspective. You start at the longest length, and you look at increasingly small scales. So I'm going to say, what if you start with a minimum length, and you scale up in exactly the same way? What happens is that you can define some extents on these objects. So here I've defined h, which is the sort of naive length of the fractal from endpoint to endpoint, as well as l, which is the actual length along the fractal. Of course, in the top-down approach, l will be infinite. But here, since we're constructing something with a finite number of generations, l is going to be related in some way to h, and they'll both be finite quantities. And the relationship is precisely that this quantity, the total length along the fractal, is the length from endpoint to endpoint raised to the d. So it really is a dimension in just as legitimate a sense as 2 is the dimension of a plane because area is length squared. So this allows you to do some very tricky things with scaling laws that are quite important for biology. And so Jacob will talk a little about that.
So I'm going to present some arguments based on some papers by a guy called Jeff West, and we'll show some references for that at the end of the talk. And he seems to be the god of this area in biology. But before I do that, we're going to just step back and look at a different way of thinking about this. So first of all, if we look at the external surface of a body, we're roughly spherical people, and we can then maybe expect that the outside of our body is not, it doesn't have this fractal structure. It's roughly quite smooth. So then if we think about that, that presumably will obey some sort of geometric law. So if we look, we can classify a body via these geometric length scales. So these might be the size of my toe or my height and things like this. And this classifies the external area of me. And then we can compute the area as a function of these different length scales. And just by dimensional analysis, we can pull out that factor L1 squared, because that's how we expect an area to scale. And then we can have this dimensionless factor of all the other length scales. And now, if we think about rescaling that L1 that we pulled out to lambda, so instead of working with meters, we work with kilometers, then we pick up this factor lambda, and what happens in the area? Well, at the front, we get this factor lambda squared because to do with the L1 squared. But then inside the phi, this dimensionless factor, they all cancel out. So all we've picked up is this factor lambda squared, which is exactly that dimension 2 that we saw before. And in the volume, we see this cube that we saw before as well. If we assume that the body is roughly uniform density, then we're going to see that the area is proportional to the mass of the body. This is the external surface area, this non-fractal area, is proportional to the mass to the power of 2/3. So this is somehow naively what we would expect based on geometry. But we might hope that we can do better by exploiting this fractal structure. Another thing to note is that in this, there's no real fundamental length scale. There was no reason that I chose the particular L1 that I chose. I could have chosen any other length scale. But if we think about something like a root system, it has some fundamental length scale. Those roots can only get down to a certain thickness. They can't go thinner than a single cell. And we're going to make the assumption that we're going to call this L0, this minimum length, and we're going to assume that this is roughly uniform across all plants or all trees, certainly within a certain group. So all plants have some common ancestors, so we expect them to have roughly similar cells. So this doesn't seem like a too outrageous an assumption to make. And then we're going to define this quantity little a, which is a function of all the length scales classifying that root system or that the network of in your blood system or your breathing system. And this now also depends on this L0, this fundamental length scale. And this A is some exchange area. So this is the surface area of this branching system. And this is where things can be exchanged with the environment. So we can exchange water through the roots. So we might suppose that we want to maximize this exchange area. And we can define this quantity V, the biological volume, the effective volume, as the product of A times L, where L is some biological length scale, which we're going to think of as the mean distance from root tip back to the body of the tree. We might suppose that we want to minimize that distance because we want water to be able to get from the root to the tree in the most in the quickest possible time. Now, what happens if we rescale all these length scales apart from L0? Because we can't scale that. That has to stay fixed because that means something. That's the cell size. Then when we try and rescale A, we pick up this factor lambda there in the dimensionless factor. And we have to decide what we're going to do about this. Now, because we know it has a self-similar structure and we know how fractals behave, we're going to assume that this phi behaves, obeys a power law. So we're going to assume that A scales in this sense. So A goes to lambda to the power 2 plus epsilon A times the original A. And we haven't defined yet what this epsilon A is, but we're going to assume that biology is going to pick the best epsilon A and the best epsilon L. So if we look now at the ratio of the area to the volume, and we're going to call this B, or the log of this is B, then this looks like this now. So before we had epsilon A equals 0, epsilon L equals 0, so you get 2/3. Now if we assume once again that the volume, V, little v, is proportional to the mass, so we can make some argument that this should be the case, then we're going to get A as proportional to m to the power b. Previously this was 2/3, but maybe biology can do better. Monica's going to tell you about that.
Okay, so remember that the fundamental assumption here is that we want to maximize this effective area. So as we see here, that this is a shift when B is maximum. So when epsilon sub L is equal to 0 and epsilon sub A is equal to 1, that's the maximum of B because those epsilon can be only among 0 and 1. And there you get B is equal to 3/4. This implies first that the fractal dimension of those lengths are 1. So those lengths are not behaving like fractal. They are being minimized, which is what we wanted. And second, the fractal dimension of the effective surface is 3. So the area is actually scaling as a volume. Considering these two parameters, we also get that the volume scales as a four-dimensional object would do, four-dimensional Euclidean object would do, and therefore those lengths are scaling as m to the 1/4. So in this study, I mean in this paper we were following, it was implied that the number of invariant unit scales, which are those related to the fundamental length L naught, are proportional to the surface, the effective surface. But we didn't see this like very, was something very straightforward. So we wanted to see two examples in which it could be or could not be true. So first, let's see at the roots. So in this case, the area which we are maximizing is actually the boundary of the fractal structure. And this is what one would expect because the water is being absorbed by what is called the root hairs. These are uniformly distributed on the whole surface of the roots. Therefore, we are maximizing what actually should be maximized. But for the case of a tree, it is different because the area which is involved in the process of absorbing energy is actually the surface of the leaves, not the boundary of the fractal structure. So we wanted to do like this very simple model, just to visualize it. We start from a cylinder, and from every step there appear like n other branches. The length is scaled by this parameter W, and we also postulated the conservation of cross section, which is a kind of true experimentally. Yes. So with this model, we calculate the area of the whole structure, and we see that if this relationship is true, then the number of tips is proportional to the area of the trunk, which is what wasn't really clear for us. And if this is true, therefore the area of the leaves is proportional to the area of the fractal structure, which is the one which is being maximized. So we can conclude that it doesn't really matter which interpretation you make of this effective area, because it could be either the boundary of the fractal structure or the real area involved in the exchange of energy. And we found some papers with experimental results. Here you can see the relationship among the leaf area and the mass of the trunk, which are related by this exponent 0.74, which is pretty much 3/4. So also we find that it will be pretty interesting to extend this model to something more abstract, because the whole development was really abstract, and the organisms we are considering are very complex systems and how well it works. So maybe we could study, for example, humans, which I mean, humans can interact with each other to obtain resources, and we can move. So the surface wouldn't be like a physical surface, but it has very good chances of working. So, yeah. Thank you.
have some time for questions.
So actually, reality is not exactly a fractal, right? But in a good approximation, it is. So when you construct the fractal, it's kind of a straightforward recipe you got to do, right? But what I was thinking about is that life, or basically nature, is random, right? The processes are nearly stochastic or random processes. So for example, the way as a tree grows is a random process. So I don't know if one can extend or create an argument with this, saying that randomness will lead eventually to some fractal structure or anything like that.
Well, I think that, first of all, there's certainly going to be some randomness involved in the actual growth pattern of a tree, for instance.
Right. Thank you. but at the same time, I mean, the development of an organization is basically the solution of an optimization problem, right? I mean, just through natural selection. And so it's not unreasonable to think that you would reach something that has some structure. I don't really know anything about developmental biology, but I assume there's a lot of very precise patterning that goes on at a genetic level. And moreover, the exact place of the branching doesn't matter so much, I think, so much as the fact that it's topologically connected in this fractal way, in this branching way. Of course, it won't be an actual fractal. There's the smallest point. But
another argument you can make is just that you look at hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different biological things. So we've made an argument about absorption area and mass. You do the same argument for consumption rate, and you see that it grows less rapidly than you would expect. You can just do this argument based on a huge number of different things. So empirically, this is true. So biology has found that it can achieve these fractal structures, even if they're imperfect, it doesn't matter.
Thank you. Based on the plot you had of the various coastlines, that most of them seem to fall below the line represented by the circle, but it was one that fell above that line instead. I was wondering if there was any sort of interesting significance to that.
I think what the important aspect of these curves is actually the slopes, which is what gives you the dimension. You can shift them linearly just by changing what your fundamental unit of measure is.
Okay.
The important part is the behavior along the curve itself.
So, I mean, is there a reason why one particular coastline is so much higher than the others?
Well, Australia is a massive place.
Yeah. Ideally,
what you want to do is non-dimensionalize the lengths, and you'd have them all the same fundamental length.
Okay, so a very naive question about fractals. Do all fractals have infinite length, or can we have something that the length converges, something like the coastline?
So I think that you probably could, because you could certainly have some converging sequence of, if you have the dimension halved each time, for instance.
Right, but would that be a fractal as well?
I think yes, in the sense that it could still be self-similar at all scales.
There are certain fundamental scales between which their self-similarity would exist. You have either a very big scale and a very small scale. If you go down to the atomic level, or all the way up to the
mathematically,
are there fractals? You mean mathematically?
Yeah.
Would it be infinite?
Then it's infinite.
It's always infinite. But
what if what if the dimension is less than one?
If the dimension was less than one, then you can take some.
Or dimension is less than one,
it's asymptotically zero dimensional. You could do it in the same way that you construct the one that has a finite area, and then you move it out, and it has zero area occupied. Presumably, you could do the same thing with a line.
Move it
out until it has zero length, and yet somehow.
But then it's sort of like a
What's a Cantor set has log 2 over log 3 dimension?
The Sapinski gasket.
Yes.
Cantor set.
Yeah.
That has would have log two over log three dimension.
You can have these
zero
dimensional Cantor dusts, which have, I think, they're the opposite of space filling. They take up none of the space that they originally.
So is this plot here suggesting that someone actually walked physically around all of these places with a ruler four or five times?
I would imagine this was done using a book of charts. but we can imagine if we don't.
Okay, let's thank all of our speakers.